Absolutely. There's an AIDS research project now that's being in the New York Times book of Dr. Yo. People went to try some of the things that he said didn't even work. I mean,
and they were just phony.
Absolutely.
Right, I'll give you a good little example of the prowlers, and very embarrassing one for me personally, that has happened in between the last time I saw you and now. And it's, talk about trivial, it is high trivia, but it's an example of, first of all, mistakes, and second of all, the relative significance of BD mistakes and how they're handled. Yeah, I'll tell you this because, for history's sake, it's interesting. And I was mad about it. I reviewed Halloween 2H2O or something, the, you know, the umpteenth Halloween movie with Jamie Lee Curtis. This was two months ago. And blah, blah, blah. Grade, you know, grade B plus horror movie. I happened to like Jamie Lee, and Janet Lee was in it too, so it had that interest. And I said, in passing, in the middle of the review somewhere, that at least I'd give the director credit for a certain amount of restraint in not having any, there was no grisly, hideous murder until an hour into the movie. And blah, 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 and that's the end. Well, it turns out, the next day, phone call after rain. What do you mean? Well, there were two horrible kind at the beginning of the movie. They're talking, it can't be. I was maybe a minute, 2 minutes late, walking the movie as the credits were coming, seeing Jamie Lee Curtis. Well, I was about 3 minutes late. I swear, no more, maybe four. And there was a pre-credit sequence, pre-title sequence, as there often
they do
is.
That.
Often do it. And it never occurred to me that such a thing, that it had happened, or that there had been such. And so I stupidly make the statement, and in fact, my son was there the same night, Ben. I said, "Ben, were you there at the beginning?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "There weren't any murders until an hour." And he said, "No, you know, at the very beginning, there were these two kids that get slashed to death." So, in other words, I made a mistake. They're right. The readers who wrote in these mean
that comes
letters.
From these Scream movies. Those two Scream movies. They start.
Yeah, the Scream movie. So the point is, I you know, that when the editor called, the entertainment for me. And I checked with Ben. I called it. No low contender. I missed the first couple minutes. I thought, all right. Well, he said, well, we got to run the. I said, of course, you have to run the letter. You're going to take them. I've taken lumps before for worse than this. And what I didn't say was what I said to Murray. I said, 3 minutes should be the most I've ever been late to a movie. I've been a half an hour. Sometimes I was an hour late to police. Okay, you know. And I managed to write reviews that didn't trip me up, you know. So I couldn't tell them. But I only do that for bad movies, when I know they're going to be bad, and I always know in advance. Anyway, the editor, Craig, was furious for some reason. Still haven't found it out. And wrote a memo to the managing editor in charge of features saying, if Paris knows this any more untruths or something like that, he's out. And I was irate. I wrote a memo. I resign now. I'm not going to be threatened. I'm in and out. I said, I can't believe this is happening again. After 10 years, with my revolving door history, rant raving to shorten the story. He soothed my feathers, said he didn't really mean that. And I said, yeah, it was my mistake anyway.
So you're still there.
But typical tempest, typical example of a mistake that's made. So my point was, how significant is it on the grand scale of things? Is it like a presidential assassination coming and you make, you know, have I libeled anybody? 2 weeks before, they had a huge correction in the paper about a murder story in which they said that the woman accused of the murder had been a prostitute, and she wasn't. And then they had to run a correction. But now that's a kind of a seriousness that harms somebody. Is Jamie Lee Curtis going to care that somebody in Pittsburgh said there wasn't a murder? Okay, enough about that incident. It's just an illustration.
Towards the end of our last time together, you mentioned Bill Black and then the whole thing out of the morgue. You were discussing the morgue,
mm-hmm.
the journal, you know.
And I think I did show you some of this picture, didn't I?
Tim
Timonese is my
yeah.
co-author.
Yeah.
Yes, in that book, I just got a call from Deborah Allward, who's the PG marketing person in charge of that, and we're moving forward on that. Okay. Because they're right here.
And who's Bill Black?
It's called Out of the Morgue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, called Out of the Morgue.
It's going to be a book?
It's going to be a coffee table book, a fabulously funny coffee table book.
You're writing it?
Well, it's photographs with captions, the original captions, and yeah, I will write kind of an essay, and Bill Block has agreed to write
prefaces. Bill Block, oh my.
And actually, I wrote it for him about 15 years ago, but now we have to update it, and he was sweet enough to approve the whole thing. And there, it's broken down into different sections as a newspaper, you know, sports, society, old-fashioned newspaper, society, police beat, teen scene, business. But just to give you an idea of some of the quirky things, what two of our, Timonies and my favorite departments are people in circles and people hiding their faces. So here's just some examples. These pictures were all to be thrown away until Timonies and I rescued them.
In the morgue. Okay, now.
And they all have the original captions on the back, and you don't have time to go through them all.
I'm gonna give it away to your friends.
Yeah, we'll give it away. For you.
You are a beggar, aren't you? Okay, now let's talk about WQED and WPXI, please.
Oh, so what about them?
Well, what's going to happen there?
Which? QED?
Well, QED is evidently staying. They're going to sell off. They have double programming.
Oh,
now.
You mean QEX?
QEX, okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that thing. You know, I don't know much about that because my 20-year affiliation with QED is with QED-FM, the radio, and though people don't believe it, there is no contact between the two, virtually. They're literally in the same building, in a way, but I never run into the TV people, and the only person I know and love is Fred Rogers there, and David Newell, but other than them, I don't even know anybody there. Well, the only thing I know about is, and can say some bitchy things about it, the previous reign of Lloyd Kaiser and Tom Skinner, which was what put them in all the trouble through extravagant spending and gigantic executive salaries and, you know, massive benefits, and all I know is that they're paying the people that do things on my little Sunday Arts Magazine program on the radio, they get paid, you know, like $50, $70 a review. While the TV side, in its heyday under, you know, the National Geographic, they would think nothing of hiring consultants for $50,000, you know, to sit around and tell them to change the logo.
So there wasn't anybody there watching the store? How did all
this
happen?
It happened because they were raking it in with these big bucks projects from, like, National Geographic when they had that contract, and
what about their contributors? Didn't they?
Everybody was as long as things were cooking along and it looked, and they were having great success and the money was coming in or appeared to be coming in, nobody thought it's like the SNL, you know. As long as everything's fine and people are at least not losing money, nobody thinks to check, you know, very much. And there've never been very serious watchdog public committees on QED finance. I guess there are now. But basically it was Kaiser and Skinner that they were in charge. They're the ones that blew all the money, and then when those contracts got canceled, they couldn't downsize fast enough or quickly enough or smart enough to get out of it. And poor Cece Summers got lost in the shuffle. She was in charge of the radio station, and she was not an extravagant spender, but because she was part of that management group, she had to go to.
Barry, we've talked about so many things. We sort of came into your house through the side door, and we've lately been coming in through the front door. We came in because of your father, and then
That's
when
right.
we realized what a treasure we have in his son.
Oh.
Truly. But we've talked about so many things, and we've had you comment on so many things. I'd like you now to talk truly about Barry Paris and what you are and what you're, how you describe where you've been and where you're going, and it's apparent that you are tremendous energy now is going into your moving in a very positive direction. In fact, it was, we talked about your, you know, being Knopf assigning you different jobs to do, books to write, and getting advances, etc. So that's where I'm coming from in trying to get you to talk about yourself.
Well, ooh, heavy
philosophical.
Don't be
modest.
Oh.
Don't be modest. Be factual.
Well,
I have the problem, the good problem, and sometimes bad problem of too many interests, and the problem I've always faced in the newspaper business, from most of the editors that I ever worked for, was, you got to specialize. You know, what are you? You're going to be a movie critic? You're going to be a classical music critic? You're going to be an investigative reporter? You know, what are you going to do? And even as they were also saying, gosh, we need somebody to review the ballet tonight. Could you go do that? Or could you interview someone in Russian for it? Oh, yeah, I could do that. So while they were taking advantage of my versatility, the system overall wasn't anybody personally. Prefers specialists, especially in the end of the 20th century. There are the universalists, the generalists are a dying breed. And Andre Previn is has this problem in music. He's, you know, how can a guy who writes movie scores and plays jazz, how can he write a serious opera? You know, he's got the same problem. He's been told that it would be good for his career to specialize, to do only one, and then be taken with fully serious. And from a crass commercial standpoint, that's true. But he won't do it. He likes too many different things. And
How about you?
That's one reason I like him. And because I'm the same way. I can't, you know, all my education college was in Slavic languages, and I've never made a dime. I've never had a job that related to, except in a peripheral way to that. Well, no, I taught Russian for 5 years, but that was while I was working for New. I don't know. So it's a long, rambling way of saying I just have to do or want to do a lot of different things. That's why I'm so happy about the Franklin Pierce book, to get out of movies for a while. I've been in the movie genre too long. Well, the Haiti book and the Stella Adler are different, but the Pierce book is something I always want. You know, my whole presidential fixation is another. So I don't know. Okay, having said all that, blah, blah, about my egotistic desires professionally, I have to say the main thing that I have been is extremely lucky and fortunate in that, among other things, that Robert Gottlieb discovered me, or I discovered him. And
New Yorker?
Yes. Rescued me from the Post-Gazette 12 years ago. He needs to do so again. Now, he did that and with the Louise Brooks book, and then with pieces in the New Yorker. And then that led to, you know, Vanity Fair and American Film and Art and Antiques and just the good fortune to be not just a professional successes, but to know, to work with these people, to work with somebody like Gottlieb, who happens to be the greatest editor in America, or Victoria Wilson at Knopf, who's one of them. And, you know, to do a book and have the opportunity to, you know, sort of live with Tony Curtis for a year and a half. That's really a very wonderful thing, and I'm grateful for it. And I just can't see why I would want to cut out any of the phases. Why would anybody want to, why would you want to stop listening to jazz because you like classical? Or why would you want to, you know, not go to see the Picasso exhibit because you like Rembrandt? So, the other thing I'm fortunate for and have to attribute really all of it to is Claire Paris and Wyoming Paris, which is brings us full circle to Wyoming and to this incredible man who, 92, is still alive, 93, and not only alive but very sharp and very healthy in the mind and not too unhealthy in the body, and we're going on a cruise at his initiation and suggestion in about 4 weeks, October. God willing, he stays.
Where are you going?
We're going to, with my brother-in-law, the three of us, the guys, are going on a cruise to, it's just a little Caribbean thing, to one of the islands, and then the Yucatan coast, and then back again. Wyoming, he's not even going to get off the boat. He's not interested in any of the, it's just the crew. It's the boat and the
company.
The company and the schmoozing and the food. The food is, of course, the main thing. The 8 meals a day in the cruise. the breakfast, the between breakfast snack, the lunch, the post lunch snack, the dinner, the midnight buffet. And anyway, he's the one that's always inspired me for his feistiness more than anything. Also, his liberal politics. And his willingness and constant example of quitting a job at a moment's, at the sign of offense, for any good or bad reason, leave it, walk away from it, don't take it. And I saw him do that 50 times in his life, and he retired he hasn't retired, but he never had one dime of a pension or savings, gets by on Social Security rather well, and to me that was a great inspiration, and his Roosevelt bent. But my mother was the artistic one who gave me books and theater and movies, and so between the two of them, again, I was very lucky, and I'm just grateful for it. And for Pittsburgh's the best place in the world to have grown up, and to be back here now. My parents are a good example. You know, poor Ukrainian Jewish immigrant and a poor second-generation German Catholic family, both of them families of nine. Only Pittsburgh produces, well, not only Pittsburgh, it seems to me like only Pittsburgh produces people like that.
So who gave you, your dad had the same, I mean, I see you and sense you having an appetite for life. I mean, truly, I mean that in a very positive sense, in a very, that you have just a, you have the intellect, you have the education, what you made of it.
Yes.
To be, really, to be to spread out with your languages and with your interests and
well,
your
thank
you. Knowledge of art. And
the appetite, I think, is a very important thing, and they certainly did. But also, someone else who's given me or equals and betters my appetite for life is Myrna Parent, who, you know, we've been married 23 years, and this woman, it makes me look like a slouch. You know, she is very dynamic and much more really positive than I am at heart. But I'm glad you mentioned the word that I forgot, and that was the word education, which is the other thing that without which nothing that I have done could I have done. I would have wanted to, but couldn't have. And my parents, neither of whom ever graduated from high school, let alone went to college, made certain that all three of me and my brother and sister had benefit not just of an education, but of very good ones that they had to spend a lot of money for that they didn't have, and without which nothing. You know, how can you? Well, no, without which, if you're Albert French, for instance, and also never grow, you can, if you're an innate genius and can rise to the top without it, as he and some people can do, more power to you, but the rest of us mortals need to be educated, and I was one of them, and my parents did that.
Train the mind, how your mind has been trained in so many, and you obviously.
Yep, I could not have had a luckier or a better set of teachers, both in starting in Turner School in Wilkinsburg, and I had the same first, second, fifth, sixth grade teachers as my sister did in the 1940s and as my brother did in the 1930s. That was the rock solid, you know, public school of those days. And then I went to my father, who's very anti-Catholic and had resisted all of my mother's efforts to put any of us in a parochial school. And when we moved to Kansas, at his insistence, I went to the Jesuit Catholic High School, Capon Memorial High School, because he overcame his anti-Catholicism when he investigated and discovered that it was indeed the best school in the state, private school. So he swallowed the Jesuits, and that's where I learned Latin and Spanish and the love of foreign languages. And then I was not going to apply. I was going to go to Wichita University because I was in my hippie anti-college period when I graduated from high school. And he said, no, you will apply, at least apply, to one good school. And so I applied to Columbia with, and refused to take the SATs. I think I told you the story. And I was sure they'd reject me, and they accepted me. So he's responsible for that, too.
But you also have the ability to go through a school like Columbia. That's, I think the inspiration came from your parents, but they had quite a bit of material to work with.
Well, once I got there,
you.
I took it seriously.
Okay.
And I was, once I got there, I was glad I was there.
And where did you, well, I can imagine, a mind like yours just soaking it all up.
Well,
where did you teach
like
Russian?
Wichita State University from 1970 to 1975. Elementary and intermediate Russian.
Did you like teaching?
Oh, I loved it. I loved teaching Russian. And then I taught here at Pitt for film, and on the semester at Seaship, film, reviewing film history. I didn't like, I hated the journalism class. I hated, and journalism 101 I got roped into once or twice. That was awful.
So you did a semester at sea?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 1984. I taught...
All your family, Myrna?
No, just me. Myrna was invited. She was invited to be one of the singing teachers, and music professors, and she couldn't go, which I've always regretted. But I did it, and it was fabulous. And I taught film there. We had 70 people in that class. It was the largest class, and of course, everybody wanted to take a movie class. And I like teaching, but it takes too much out of me. It's been... First of all, I have to write out lectures. I'm not fond of ad-libbing, so, and that would take me forever. And then I'd make a sign. Well, like in Russian, any elementary language class, you must give, students must have, one assignment every night. And it's a five-day-a-week class. There's no other way to learn language. So I found myself for all those years, with like 25 papers every night to grade. Just like the poor, schleppy grade school teacher with his book. And it would be hours and hours. So I got exhausted by it. But I always liked it.
To me, from what I'm hearing, and I don't mean to be presumptuous, I have the feeling that the intellectual stimulation, et cetera, is, I'm hearing more about writing and the people you meet, the publishers, the editors, your subjects seem to be what has excited you the most in the work that
the people.
Not the writing necessarily.
Oh, well, rephrase the question.
I have
I'll be Bill Clinton from the grand jury.
is. What does it mean?
Yeah, is. It depends on what is.
I.
What do you mean by writing? No, go ahead.
With invisible ink.
You know, this is the first cigarette. Wasn't
I'm
I good?
Proud of you.
Wasn't
I'm
I
proud
good?
Of you.
An hour and a half.
That's fine.
Okay.
Did the cognac help?
It's schnapps. No,
okay.
It didn't. I only had a few sips.
I'm
disgustingly sober.
I have the feeling, in listening to you and having interviewed you for so long and listening to some of the things that you said, that some of the most intellectually stimulating, interesting things where you have used really all of the tools is in writing. You mentioned that you enjoy meeting the people, you enjoy meeting your two editors that you feel are the two fine, Gottlieb and Gallic Knopf.
Vicki Wilson.
And also the people that you've met. I mean, you've gone to Haiti with the melons and with
my octaves.
And also Marsha Davenport, they're your languages.
Mm-hmm. Check. Yes, now I understand, I think, the question. And yes, I would say that writing is not one of the most important things or ways that those things came together, but by far it's the way. It's the main way. And, I see what you mean. It's also been a very personal thing, too, when you become friends with these people. But for me, it's inseparable. Writing about people and being friends with them is inseparable, almost. publishing is about them is different. I do lots of writing that's not published, and that's secondary, whether or not you publish it. But I can't imagine not writing about it because for me, it's not just an art form, it's not just my art form, which it is, but it's the only way that I clarify my thought, thinking about the people, and then about the time, and then about the place, and then about the history. Because basically at heart, and I'm coming full circle to it now with Franklin Pierce, just reading this incredible collection of Jefferson Davis letters, a bunch of which are to and from Pierce. At heart, basically, I'm really, I'm a historian, archivist. I think that's sort of the bottom line. And, a writer, and then an artist. And so by writing about these people and things, I get a sense of placing them in the times as well as in my life. It's not just, it's the problem with bad writers is that they're only concerned with placing people and events in their lives. There's no way that you cannot want to place them in your lives, but that can't be the only thing that you do. You have to have, or at least I think I have and like to have, a sense and an ability to put them in some kind of historical framework so that when I'm gone, at least if nothing else, that'll be around.
Do you have to like them?
No, but it helps. No, I write about a lot of people that I love. I'm doing a piece now on Charlton Heston and gun control. I'm doing one on, I've done a lot on Richard Nixon, Spiro Agnew, people that I truly hate and can't stand. And I get, you know, I love writing. Clarence Thomas, one of my best articles for In Pittsburgh was on Clarence Thomas, was with the headline that they actually ran. The title of it was Penises on Parade. And they ran it. So no, I like writing about, but those are, I must say, for the most part, articles. It would be hard to write a book about them. Although somebody has to write a book about Hitler, right? You can't always like.
Exactly.
But it helps, and I have a tendency to like people, especially the octaves. And that's the other thing that I've been fortunate with from childhood, which is that because my parents had these gigantic families, you know, I told you each of them had 9 brothers and sisters, but my mother's family, her father, had 16. And so I grew up with lots of ancient relatives. Many of them were still alive then, about 7 or 8 of the 16, late 80s, 90s. And I used to love to sit and talk to them. And my mother would lecture me about it. Now, spend a little time with Aunt Regina. You don't know how much longer she'll be with. And my sister and I would talk. And a lot of people, younger people, don't like older people, or aren't comfortable, or haven't been exposed to them, and would rather avoid them. And again, thank God I felt always the opposite. So to talk to an 89-year-old feisty Marcia Davenport did terrify me, but I was able to do it. And Lena Basquette didn't terrify me at all, and I loved doing it. I'd go up every 2 weeks. So those are the people, and also they're the ones whose memories are that you want to preserve, and whose lives you have to preserve sooner.
In some of the people that you write about, whom you don't like, some of them you might even hate, did you get in starting to write about any of these people, whether it's Nixon or Clarence Thomas? Anita Hill had an article in the paper today.
Did she?
Yeah, very interesting.
I like
reading. And did you learn anything about them that might, where you would find some redeeming quality that you didn't know they had?
Oh, I think usually, yes. It's like, you know, until you walk in someone's shoes from around here. You know, and Richard Nixon had, you know, grew up in that disgusting Whittier and had that, you know, weird Quaker thing. The other one. I've been working in my mind on an article about Rick Santorum. I can't stand this man. This is the worst twerp of a senator that we ever got stuck with. And there must be something good about him. I haven't found it yet. Mount Lebanon. Anyway. Yeah, there are good things about people. Well, this is, in a way, if you take Pierce, he's, you know, my hero and anti-hero in American presidential. He was a terrible president, but he was at heart a wonderful man. And, different case. But, yeah, you have to be able to see the positive in the negative. You can't just, unless it's Jesse Hill.
Now, you have been a critic, and when the tables are reversed.
Who hates criticism more than a critic?
Okay.
I get. I'd like to pretend that I don't read reviews at all, or I'm not bothered by negative ones, but I'm not. I read them, and I get irate about it, and feel terribly wounded and offended and unappreciated, and all the things that other people do by my have felt by my negative reviews over the years. So it's God's way of punishing me, and it's poetic justice or unpoetic justice. Yeah, I'm real sensitive.